Hello, I'm Frank Kermit. This is number 0495, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0495. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, we remember actor Christoph St. John from The Young and the Restless, who passed away last week at the age of 52, the very young age of 52, with part of an interview that we did back in 2004. He shared many stories, including how he made a phone call to get himself on Y&R.
I made a call to CBS over to Y&R, and I spoke to the coordinating producer, Nancy Wired, and told her, hey, I'm available. She said, who are you? I said, well, you know, I'm working on this show that's about to be canceled, and I'd love to come over and meet with you people if you think I'm right for your show. And within 2 weeks, I had a meeting with the creator, Bill Bell Sr., and it happened to be the day that Bush Sr. was ordering the airstrike on Baghdad. Mm-hmm. So I sat in Sr.'s office. We watched the airstrike. It was rather ominous, and then he turned to me and he said, how'd you like to be on my show?
Astronaut Terry Virts is the author of View from Above.
You know, I was planning on taking photographs. I'm a photographer. I always have been since I was a kid. So I didn't want to write a memoir. There's a million astronaut memoirs. That story's been told 100 times. I really wanted to share what it's like in space. So it's not an atlas of, you know, here's Canada and here's the Sahara and here's Australia. It's not that at all. It's like, what does it feel like to launch? What does it feel like to do a spacewalk? What does it feel like to see the planet and all the colors and beauty? It's more, what is it like in book format?
Douglas Bevins and Alea Boisvert are co-hosts of the podcast Adventures in Co-Parenting. Where did the idea for the podcast come from?
I think it came from a feeling that we both experienced pretty early on, that there weren't a lot of resources or support available to us, or that it wasn't common. And there definitely weren't community spaces where you could sort of tune in and hear and share stories.
And there's no training manual or guidebook for how to parent. And when you add on the potential complexity of raising a child with now an ex, there's like a whole lot of emotions and practical challenges that can come up.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0495, was relationship coach Frank Kermit. He's been a guest on this program many times, and you can check out his website by going to our website at thestufffile.com, checking the show number for this program, which you just heard Frank say, 0495, and you'll find the link. Synergy. It's all synergy. Thank you very much, Frank, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, here's a story that might creep you out just a little bit. For UNC Greensboro student Maddie, whose last name wasn't provided for this story, and I think you'll know why in a moment, there really was a monster in the closet, or at least a guy named Drew. After returning to her apartment on February 2nd, Maddie heard strange noises coming from her closet. She put her hand on the door and said, "Who's in there?" "My name's Drew," answered the intruder. Maddie continued talking to him, and when she opened the door, Drew was sitting on the floor of the closet, dressed in her clothing. He also had a bag full of her clothes, her shoes, and her socks. 30-year-old Andrew Clyde Swafford begged her not to call police, and she chatted with him for about another 10 minutes. "Everything about his life and basically how he got in my closet," she said. Swafford left when Maddie's boyfriend arrived, and police caught up with him at a nearby gas station where he was arrested for misdemeanor breaking and entering. Maddie told reporters she thinks Swafford has been in her apartment before. "We always joke that there's a ghost in here because I've been missing clothes since I've been living here." She signed a lease for a new apartment a few days later. Yikes! Just plain yikes! While you're listening to this, please feel free to walk around your place checking all the closets. Heck, you can even check under the beds if you want. I'll understand if you want to do that. It doesn't say in the story how long Maddie was living in the apartment, but if it was even just a week, that's 1 week too long. I wonder if Drew picked her apartment because it was easy access or because he and Maddie wore the same size. Again, yikes. Okay, while you're working hard to get that last story out of your head, let me bring up this next one for you. But first, let me start off with the headline of the story because I defy anyone who can read the headline and not want to hear the details. The headline is, accused horse molester allegedly tried to burgle home with stun gun and sex toy. Yeah, if that isn't an attention grabber, I don't know what is. Anyway, here's the story. A man accused of molesting a horse is now accused of trying to break into an Alabama home with a stun gun and a sex toy. 19-year-old Daniel James Bennett was arrested on charges including attempted burglary. Mobile County Sheriff's deputies say Bennett was knocking on doors in an Irvington neighborhood and tried climbing through one resident's window. Deputies say Bennett also had a pair of hairstyling scissors and a pair of razor blades in his possession. Bennett was accused last year of molesting a 20-year-old mare named Polly and charged with offenses including sexual misconduct. Authorities say he admitted to his crime. Okay, double yikes. I think it was Jed Clampett who said it best.
Someday I gotta have a long talk with that boy.
Meanwhile, I'm sure the horse is probably wondering why he never called back, never texted, or never wrote. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first segment here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? We recently lost one of the most popular soap stars on television, actor Christoph St. John, who, for the last 27 years, has played Neil Winters on The Young and the Restless, died at the age of 52. He was found dead in his California home on February 3rd. Christoph was a second-generation actor who had carved out an amazing career right out of the gate as a child star. I had the pleasure of talking to him on several occasions. The first time was back in September of 2004. Here's a bit of that conversation now. You have been playing Neil Winters for quite some time, since what, January of 91?
It's been about a 13 and a half year run. Yeah, it's been a while, hasn't it? Feels like I started yesterday, though, let me tell you.
Well, that's always a good thing in a job, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It means that the time is going by quickly and I'm having some fun.
Although acting is something that's in your family tree, is it not?
Yeah, it's been... My dad's an actor. He starred in Shaft.
I was about to say your dad was in one of my favorite films.
Oh, no kidding, huh?
Shaft, absolutely.
Right on. Well, it was Richard Roundtree, Moses Gunn, and my father, Christopher St. John, headed up Shaft in 1971, which won an Academy Award. Isaac Hayes won for the music. But, I remember seeing my dad on film, not that particular film because it was R-rated, and asking him if I could become an actor. And he didn't let me for a couple of years. And then finally, when I was about eight, he said, okay, it's time. You know, so, you know, my first gig was an episode of a show called That's My Mama and then Happy Days. I was part of the original Happy Days thing.
But that's...
You know, it's been a nice ride. 31 years, and it's still going strong.
That's My Mama, Clifton Davis?
How do you know that?
I used to watch That's My Mama.
Holy mackerel.
When Ted Lange used to come... The only thing that used to annoy me with that show was Ted Lange coming into that barbershop every day.
Yep,
spinning
right.
Around and going, woo-wee. I said, okay, enough.
This is my kind of show. No, but no doubt. That was the golden era of television, the 70s. And, once we got into the 80s, we kind of lost a little bit of heat. But, the sitcom world was really thriving back in the 70s.
Well, when you say the golden age of television, it was also a golden age for black performers.
To a certain extent, yeah. You're right. Well, you know, honestly, it was the blaxploitation era.
Right.
I mean, that hit mid-late 60s and continued through the mid-70s. And Rosie Grier was part of that. Melvin Van Peebles, Ron O'Neill, Richard Roundtree. I mean, there was some, you know, Fred Williams, some real serious pioneers of black cinema back then.
Now, tell me, how did you get the gig? How did the Young and the Restless come to you some 14 years ago?
I'll tell you, I was doing a show in 89 called Generations, and that lasted for 2 years.
Oh, on NBC with Richard Roundtree again.
Absolutely right, yeah. Richard joined our cast about a year into it, and Vivica Fox, she played my girlfriend for about a year and a half. And when that show went down in flames, I made a call to CBS over to YNR, and I spoke to the coordinating producer, Nancy Wired, and told her, hey, I'm available. She said, who are you? I said, well, you know, I'm working on this show that's about to be canceled, and I'd love to come over and meet with you people if you think I'm right for your show. And within 2 weeks, I had a meeting with the creator, Bill Bell Sr., and it happened to be the day that Bush Sr. was ordering the airstrike on Baghdad. Mm-hmm. So I sat in Sr.'s office. We watched the airstrike. It was rather ominous, and then he turned to me and he said, how'd you like to be on my show? And, you know, of course, I said, you know, very happily, yes. And he said, I have a few shows for you, and if it works out well, we'll sign you to a contract. And after the first show finished taping, he called me to his office, and he invited me to be a part of the cast.
Now, that was very proactive on your part to just waltz over there and say, I want to be on your show.
Yeah, well, you know, hey, man, at the time, I had one child, my son, Julian, and I thought the best move for me to make right now is coming off the last play, Soap Generations, see if I can't whittle my way over to the number one show. And, yeah, God was with me, man. I'm very grateful that I made that phone call.
Now, what about the whole idea of being in soaps in general? Because, you know, there are some actors who, let's be honest, are not big on the soaps. I, myself, am a big soap fan.
Right.
And I know the hard work you guys put into doing the show. I've been on the set in New York City over at As the World Turns, and I see the work that goes into that and the amount of dialogue you have to go through, the amount of work you have to go through. There are no repeats. They're hour-long shows. It's a lot of hard work, yet some people still seem to look down on the industry of soap work and soap actors.
Yeah, it's not a pleasant feeling, but you know, it's changed a little bit in the past, I feel, the past 10 years or more. I think, you know, people are in the entertainment industry are living off the concept that soaps are mediocre material, that it's the training ground for young actors. And, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, soaps were hard-pressed to get, you know, really good up-and-coming talent. And so, you know, now it's laced with a lot of veterans, a lot of people who have, you know, like Eric Braeden and Maurice Bernard over on General Hospital and, you know, Anthony Geary, people who have, you know, they're journeymen. They've been around a long time and they're very talented. And so, you know, the bar has been raised and the industry doesn't really recognize that. And so that's why I feel, you know, a lot of the producers that do features and primetime television still kind of look down on the soap medium. And it's unfortunate, but it's what it is.
You came from the television series Generation, so you came from a television show which had a core black family in its show,
right.
And you're working on a show now which does have strong black characters on it. Has it ever been a fight or a difficulty to get a storyline or get representative storyline for your characters on that show? How good have the Bells have been in getting that done?
Well, when I arrived, they were doing a storyline at the time with the character of Drusilla and Nathan, Victoria Rowell and Nathan Perdee. And she was an illiterate young lady who, you know, wanted to learn how to read and write. And Nathan guided her through that. And the next stop was Neil Winters, the young buppy, the black yuppie, who very educated, articulate, and romanced the character of Drusilla. I like to call it sort of an educating Rita storyline where, you know, he did his own sort of education of, you know, the arts and culture and being a dancer, a ballet dancer that she was and is, he really looked up to her for doing that. You know, so far, the past 14 years, the Bells have managed to put front-burning topical storylines, you know, to the audience, and you know, they've always been very good about keeping the black characters front and center. Currently, we're doing an adoption storyline, which affects millions of African American and Latino children. So, you know, I've often asked Bill, you know, his advice for writing, because I also write, and you know, his advice has been golden. He's the master storyteller, and I think he's managed to give a lot of colorless themes to The Young, the Restless through our storylines. It's, you know, it's they're universal sort of storylines. We haven't had, per se, a black topical storyline. You know, the Abbotts could have the same storylines as we do, or the Newmans. It just so happens that the Winters family is black, and yes, we are a black core family on daytime.
I remember, too, going back to, I guess, the 80s, when Diane Carroll, who herself was a pioneer with her television series on NBC, oh so many years ago.
Right.
When she appeared on Dynasty, and she said a very telling thing, which I thought was very important at the time. She thought, people would talk to her about the breakthrough role she had as Julia in the 60s, and she thought that the role she was playing on Dynasty was even more of a breakthrough role, because she thought, at last, this was an opportunity where a black character who was well-read and well-versed could play, quote-unquote, the bitch.
Right.
That it wasn't a black character just playing a down and on their luck villain,
right,
or always playing a very pious character. It was getting down and dirty with the rest of the cast.
Absolutely. And that's, I would echo the same thing about Young and the Restless. You know, again, touching on the theme of colorless sort of storylines, you know, yes, you know, black folk, you know, we have the same dreams and fantasies and the same pitfalls and, you know, that our white counterparts have. And so I can understand when she would say that, you know, for the first time she felt like she was really thriving with good material, because I worked with Diane Carroll a long time ago on a project called Sister, Sister.
Mm-hmm.
I was only 11 years old, but the cast was Diane Carroll, Irene Cara, and Rosalind Cash, and Dick Anthony Williams.
Wow.
And what an amazing actress Diane Carroll is. I mean, truly one of the gifted elite performers, not just black performers, but performers of our time.
What do you enjoy the most working on a soap, and what do you enjoy the least working on a soap?
Gosh, you know, the most fun I have is putting on a production pretty much every other day of the week. I mean, we bowl through 80 pages of material every day. I don't work every day, nor does any of the characters. Victor Newman would probably be, you know, the one character that works the 4 and 5 day weeks, as well we know, Eric Braden. But
mm-hmm.
You know, I love the scheduling. It's fantastic. It gives me a chance to spend time, quality time, with my family. I'm usually done in the afternoon, the early hours. I'm able to pick up my kids from school. I'm able to, you know, really put in my time with them. So that would be, you know, the thing that I adore the most about the job. The least, we already kind of talked about it, is the kind of the tendency to look down upon the daytime arena,
mm-hmm.
the actors, the writers, the directors, etc., by the rest of the entertainment community. And the one thing that I didn't mention earlier about possibly, you know, one of the problems is soaps have been known and are notorious for putting shock value storylines to the audience. This is for the ratings, and so you'll get, you know, people sleeping with each other, stealing sperm, you know, very strange kind of, but real life events that occur, And that is one of the, you know, that is one of the reasons why, again, the entertainment industry is a little bit down on the soaps.
You've had the opportunity now to play the role for 14 years on the, or almost 14 years on the television series. Writers come and writers go. Cast come and cast go. You're there for quite some time. Have you now reached the point where you can say to somebody, oh, I don't think Neil would do that?
All the time, man. All the time. I would say about 30% of the dialogue that you hear from my voice is, you know, somehow manipulated by me.
Mm-hmm.
I take the material and I manage to make it work for what I feel the character should be doing or saying. And the writers don't exactly like it and appreciate it, but when it's better than, what can they say?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that is the truth. There are other actors who do the same thing. Victoria Rowell, Eric Braeden, Peter Bergman, you know. I try to remain as truthful as I can, you know, to the character year in and year out. And nobody knows my character better than me.
How different is Christoph St. John from Neil Winters?
Well, I'm very different. I mean, you know, Neil is, he's a bit of a stuffed shirt. You know, he wears a suit and a tie most of the time.
Right.
He seems to be quite uptight, and you know, that's not me. I wear jeans and t-shirts most of the time. You know, one of the likenesses though is Neil is a heavy family man. I am that and much more. I love my kids. I have three of them, and you know, the Neil. He's very in touch with his family, yet he only has one daughter.
In 1999 and 2000, you were nominated for a Daytime Emmy, but you won it in, 1992?
Yes, that's correct.
How did that feel?
Hey, man, it was a glorious feeling. I didn't expect to win that year, and when they called my name, I felt like I was floating on cloud nine. It was very ethereal. I worked my way to the stage. I gave my acceptance speech, and I hit the press room. It was quite nice. But, you know, the awards, they're good accolades along the way, but, you know, truly, they don't add up to much other than, you know, personal victory. It does not earn me any more money on the show. It doesn't get me a gig outside of the show. It's simply a nice accolade.
Where do you have the Emmy?
I have it actually on top of a tower that I put all my videotapes and DVDs in. And it's been there ever since.
Now, where do you put your six NAACP Image Awards?
Those are strewn about the house. I'm about to put them all in the garage temporarily. We're looking to move soon.
Mm-hmm.
We have a kind of a small home that we're looking to expand. Now, with the third baby in our lives, it's time to get the, you know, the bigger house.
Right.
So I have one son in high school. A daughter in middle school, and a 16-month-old that's just greeting the world.
The amount of time you've put into that show now, I'm sure you're very, very comfortable being there. As you said earlier, for so many, unfortunately, in the business, they seem to think it's a stepping stone to other things, but you're quite comfortable at YNR, aren't you?
Sure I am, yeah. As I stated earlier, it gives me a chance to be the family guy that I like to be. You know, if I was working on a primetime show like CSI or, you know, Joan of Arcadia, I'd be spending 14-hour days away from my family. I would not be able to participate in their, you know, progression like I do. And would I trade YNR for a primetime show? Probably not. You know, I mean, it would really have to depend on what the primetime show is. I'm having a great time. You know, I love the people that I work with. Vicky is golden, Victoria Rowell, Tanya Lee Williams, Eric Braeden. I mean, there's some real talented people, you know, on our set. And I am proud to be a member of the show and to represent YNR wherever I go.
And representing YNR was something that Christoph St. John did well for over 25 years. But sadly, he won't get to do that anymore. Christoph died at the very young age of 52 on February 3rd, 2019. He was a most engaging and fun person to talk to. That was just a small portion of several conversations we had together. Patreon subscribers to the Stuff File program, you can hear more of Christoph St. John as a Patreon reward extra. Just go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. There, you'll hear Christoph talk about his family, his co-stars, his desire to write scripts and direct. Plus, you'll also hear one segment where I had a budding young soap actor in training calling in to get some advice from Christoph. You'll hear that and more as a Patreon reward extra. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to astronaut Terry Virts. He's the author of the book View from Above. Plus, Douglas Bevins and Alea Boisvert are the co-hosts of a podcast called Adventures in Co-Parenting. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on and much more Stuff File news here on a show that is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and it can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. An Indiana woman who barked at a police dog attracted the attention of officers who arrested her on outstanding warrants. Lafayette police say officers were conducting a traffic stop when 20-year-old Kiana Champagne Fletcher, who was standing in front of her home, began barking at a police dog sniffing the stopped car. Officers recognized Fletcher and knew she had two outstanding warrants. Police say Fletcher ran inside her house, but officers arrested her after obtaining a search warrant. Fletcher remains jailed on warrants for conversion, which is a form of theft, and operating a vehicle without a license. She's also facing preliminary charges of possessing methamphetamine and drug paraphernalia after police say they found the drugs in her home. I guess no one had a translator because nowhere in the story does it mention what she and the police dog were conversing about. And why is it that people with outstanding warrants always seem to do something to draw attention to themselves? The warrants may be outstanding, but clearly these folks are not. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Astronaut Terry Virts has been in space twice, a two-week mission on the Space Shuttle Endeavour back in 2010, and a 200-day stay on the International Space Station in 2014 and 2015. He's also the author of the National Geographic book View from Above, which combines some of his best photographs from space with stories that share the experience of spaceflight. Terry joins us via Skype from Texas. Hi, Terry.
Hello. Good to be there. Bonjour.
Thanks for being on the program with us, and it's a pleasure to have a chance to talk to you. Now, as I mentioned, you were on two missions. One was a space shuttle mission. One was on the space station. When you went to the space station, it was after the time that the space shuttle missions were ended. So what was it like? What was the difference for you traveling on a space shuttle and traveling on a Russian rocket?
So that's a great question. The overall experience of going through training and then having this mapped out launch countdown and then leaving the planet, that was similar, but the rocket itself was different because the shuttle was more like a big muscle car. The engines made this huge roar during first stage when the solid rockets are vibrating or running. There's this vibration that's the biggest I've ever felt. It's like somebody grabbing you and shaking you as hard as they can. It was just such a massive beast, 4 million pounds, you know, almost 2 million kilograms. The Soyuz, on the other hand, is an ICBM, so that's more like a sports car. When that rocket lights, you are gone. It is bang, and you smash back in your seat. When staging happens, when the first stage engine shuts off, then the second stage one, it is a huge bang. You're thrown forward in your seat, and then a couple seconds later, another bang, and you're thrown back in your seat, kind of like a Hollywood movie. So the big picture is the same, but the experience of riding a rocket was very different.
From, and also comparing the two, wouldn't the space shuttle from the capsule perspective of it be a little more spacious than the Soyuz capsule?
That is a very good point. Now, in both of them, you're in this really uncomfortable, bulky, cramped spacesuit. But the shuttle is, you know, like an airliner cockpit. There's room. The Soyuz is like a public, you know, telephone booth or something. You're just crammed in there. You can't extend your legs because the spaceship's not that big. You have to have your knees up in your chest. So, yeah, to say it's more cramped is an understatement for sure.
Now, your National Geographic book, A View from Above, which, as I said, combines some of the best photographs from space with stories that share the experience of space flight. Was this something that you had planned on doing before you went up into space? Or was this something that while you were there or when you came back, you'd say, maybe there's a book here?
No, you know, I was planning on taking photographs. I'm a photographer. I always have been since I was a kid. And that was something I really wanted to do. I did a lot of social media on my Astro Terry Twitter and Instagram accounts. But when I decided to leave NASA about a year after I got back from my flight, one of the things I wanted to do right away was write a book just to share the experience. I didn't want to write a memoir. There's a million astronaut memoirs. That story has been told 100 times. I really wanted to share what it's like in space. So it's not an atlas of, you know, here's Canada and here's the Sahara and here's Australia. It's not that at all. It's like, what does it feel like to launch? What does it feel like to do a spacewalk? What does it feel like to see the planet and all the colors and beauty? It's more, what is it like in book format?
When you take pictures up in space, like I understand how it works when you're in the shuttle, or maybe I don't know how it works when you're in the shuttle or the space station, but you took some pictures while also spacewalking. Physically, how did you do that? What kind of camera were you using? How did you release the shutter? How does that physically work in space?
Right. So one of the most awesome things about being a photographer, when you're in space, you have every kind of camera. We've had Nikon, Canon, Red, everything. But on the spacewalk itself, we had a Nikon D2, which was an older Nikon digital professional camera. So when you see the reporters taking pictures of the president or whatever, that's one of the kind of cameras they're holding up. Now they're up to the D5, so it's just a more modern version of the same big, kind of bulky camera. And we have a shield that goes around it. It's made out of this kind of like a blanket material, metallic blanket, and it keeps it from getting too hot, too cold. There's a big, giant shutter button because the gloves that you have are like snow mittens. I mean, they're not comfortable. They're very difficult. There's no dexterity, so you can kind of wrap your hand around it and sort of find the shutter button and push. And when you push, there's a big green light on the back that tells you that you actually took a picture, because otherwise there's no feedback. You can't hold the camera up to your eye because there's a helmet visor that's, you know, 10 centimeters from your eyeball. So you can't put the camera right up to your eye. But that's how it works. And the big problem with the camera is, what do you do with it? Some people leave it in the cargo bag, so they have to like go over kind of to their suitcase and pull the camera out every time they want a picture. But if you do that, then you don't ever take any pictures. So I took my camera and I kind of wedged it in my chest pack, which worked. You know, it wasn't great. But the biggest problem with taking pictures on a spacewalk was time. I felt super, super, super busy. Like, I've never been on the clock as much as I was on my spacewalk. So while I took over 300,000 pictures during my mission, on each of my spacewalks, I only took maybe 10 or 15 still images because I just didn't have time. Yeah, I would love to go to a spacewalk to just take pictures, but that wasn't the mission, and I just didn't have any time to take the shots.
As someone who spent 213 days and 10 hours on the space station, the idea of being up there and just seeing all that there is to see, how long did it take before you could, you know, literally close your mouth and not go, wow? Like, did it ever become routine, what you were seeing out the window?
You know, that is so hard, especially for a first-time flyer, especially that first few hours, because you look out the window and there's not a word. I mean, you'll say wow just because your brain forces a word to come out. There's no words to describe it. So I always tell people, you can't imagine how beautiful it is, but you actually can't. I had spent my whole life looking at astronaut photography, but until I saw the Earth for the first time, it was just this amazing thing. So for me, my entire space mission was this contrast of amazing, sublime thoughts and views and experiences with 99% completely mundane, just doing work, being a mechanic, you know, organized, putting the food away when you open a new food bag, just doing whatever mundane tasks you have to do, punctuated on a semi-regular basis with this, wow, I can't believe what I'm seeing. For me, it never got old. I think for some folks, they're just happy to be there. They want to get their work done. They're more focused on the work. But for me, I was more focused on the planet and the universe. And of course, I got all my work done and think that aspect of our mission went really well. But I also really appreciated the view that I was getting and knew that there's nothing like it.
With all your training, both for the Space Shuttle Endeavour flight that you took and also for your training to be on the space station, you've got to prepare for everything. You obviously talked to previous astronauts about their experiences, but even with all that knowledge, what is something that you were not prepared for or you were really wowed by going into space?
You know, I think the view I had seen, like I was talking about, I had seen other astronauts' photography books. I'd seen pictures from space. I'd talked to astronauts. I was in the office for almost 10 years before I first flew. So I kind of thought I knew what I was getting into. But as we launched at nighttime, I saw America, the East Coast, actually up to Montreal at night. That was amazing. There were so many. My whole chapter one is about all these crazy things that happened during launch. But when we finally flew into the sunrise, over the North Atlantic, a few minutes after the engine shut down, it was just so overwhelming. I thought, I just can't imagine. And I just wanted to sit there and stare at it. And then I had to, no, wait, I'm flying the space shuttle and we have to turn the hydraulic pumps off and we have to do all these things that were really important. And I guess I hadn't thought of the level of distraction that Earth would be. Luckily, I was able, you know, everybody's highly trained and we're able to overcome that. But it really is, you know, distracting.
213 days in space. What was it like trying to acclimatize to Earth, its orbit, its gravity, when you came back home?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. The first mission, I think, everybody feels dizzy when they get back. The first mission, I felt very heavy. I mean, I thought everything just felt like it weighed 1,000 pounds. But my second mission, it was over 200 days, and that was really a dizzy-centric mission the first day. I was able to walk. NASA makes you do this balance test where you close your eyes and go one foot in front of the other. I was able to...
Sort of like a sobriety test, almost.
It was a sobriety test, exactly. And I was able to lay on my stomach and stand up as fast as I could, walk around, you know, by myself. But, man, I wanted a handrail nearby or somebody with me just in case. I felt just really overpoweringly dizzy. But I recovered really, really quickly. They had never seen this before. A week after landing, I went and did the official balance test. You stand in this big box. It's like a small room, and it moves around, and they measure your feet and the force that your feet are putting down, you know, and if you're wobbly, your feet are really back and forth and forward and backward and lots of force changes. And if your balance is good, your feet are very steady. And so my balance score on this test a week after landing was better than what it had been before launch. And that was crazy. I couldn't believe it, but they had never seen that before. So for whatever reason, my body really adapts very well. And I guess I'm just blessed and lucky that way.
Was there much of a weight loss when you returned, or conversely a weight gain after returning?
I joke. The going into space is like most weight loss programs, you know. You lose all of your weight, but like most programs, you gain it all back. I probably lost a kilogram a month, maybe a little more than that. Everybody loses weight in space. There's just some muscle that goes away that you don't ever use, and so you lose that. You also don't have McDonald's or eat out restaurants, or, you know, the NASA food is pretty good. It's pretty varied, but it's also healthy. There's not, you know, fried American junk food. So. And you exercise 2.5 hours a day. So a combination of losing muscle through just not using them and eating healthy and exercising, I lost 5 or maybe 7 or 8 kilos, but it was a good weight loss. Like, I came back really in shape. It was kind of like going to a health spa for 7 months.
Well, I'm sure McDonald's is planning a drive-through in space somewhere. The book is the book is called View from Above. Who did you want to focus this book on? Who did you see your audience as being?
You know, I did not have a target demographic of, you know, 18 to 25 year old boys or 45 to 55 year old women, or I didn't have any kind of focus group. I wanted to take my spaceflight experience, what I saw, what I felt, what I did, what it's like to go from launch to landing and live, not just do a mission in outer space, but actually like move to outer space and live there. What is it like in space for everybody? I mean, kids are interested in it, adults are interested in it, Americans, Europeans, Chinese. I've had a chance to go to China 5 times last year. They are fascinated by space. The little kids come dressed up in their little astronaut outfits, you know, just like they do when I go to Canada or when I do go to America. It's a universal human interest in what's it like in space. And that was the question I tried to answer. And it's not just for one group, it's for everybody.
Again, the book is called View from Above. It's written by Terry Virts, which also includes many of his pictures. It's a National Geographic book. Terry, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Great to be there, and can't wait to come back to Canada in person one of these days.
Astronaut Terry Virts, who is the author of the National Geographic book, View from Above. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0495, and you'll find links to Terry's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You know, he was such a fun guest to talk to, and Patreon subscribers to the Stuff File program, you can hear more of Terry as a Patreon reward extra. Just go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. 209 years ago this week, one of the most respected leaders our nation has ever known was born. His name? Abraham Lincoln. While most of us remember Lincoln as one of our greatest presidents, many believe he was also one of the wisest lawyers ever to practice law in America, too. Oh, he lost his share of cases, but his high ideals and his refusal to sue another person unless it was a last resort earned him great respect. Listen to what he said to his fellow lawyers on the topic of suing another person. And I quote, "Discourage litigation. Persuade your neighbors to compromise whenever you can. Point out to them how the nominal winner is often a real loser in fees, expenses, and waste of time." End of quote. What wonderful advice. Now, let's be fair. Lincoln knew that people will have disputes from time to time, but he also knew that often there are better ways of resolving them than in court. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test later.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk about adventures in co-parenting. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming up in a few moments here on the program. But I've got one more Stuff File news story to share here on a program that is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. A man who police say placed a 3-foot alligator on top of another man in Connecticut as part of an extortion attempt has pleaded guilty to reduced charges. 30-year-old Isaias Garcia of Garland, Texas, entered his plea to unlawful restraint. Garcia originally faced kidnapping, assault, and larceny charges in what police said was one of the strangest cases they have investigated. Authorities say a 21-year-old man called his aunt in April to say that he had been kidnapped and his abductor was demanding $800. Police say she received a photograph of him face down in a bathtub with an open-mouth alligator on top of him. Authorities later arrested Garcia at a Shelton hotel. He faces up to 1 year in prison during his sentencing on March the 15th. Now, who the heck uses a live alligator as a weapon? Also, where the heck do you get a live alligator to use as a weapon in Bridgeport, Connecticut? Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Douglas Bevins and Alea Boisvert are the co-hosts of a podcast called Adventures in Co-Parenting. They are a former couple who for the last 6 years have raised their child together after breaking up. Their show is billed as a refreshingly honest and easygoing exploration of the highs and lows of co-parenting in the modern world. Douglas and Alea are both on with us via Skype from British Columbia. Hi, guys.
Hey, Peter.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for being on the program with us. And for the purposes of this show, we should mention the fact that you're on together in separate locations.
That's right, right. We do things together and we do things apart. It's a great arrangement.
With most couples sadly breaking up these days as opposed to staying together, the opportunities of co-parenting is greater than it was ever before. A lot of people have difficulties with it. You are diving in feet first and are doing a show about this. Where did you get the idea to do this show as just beyond the idea of co-parenting your child?
I think it came from a feeling that we both experienced pretty early on when Cohen was about one, that there wasn't a lot of there weren't a lot of resources or support available to us, or that it wasn't common. And there definitely weren't community spaces where you could sort of tune in and hear and share stories. So I think that was probably the germ of it.
Mm-hmm. And I'll add just to say that, you know, parenting is obviously very common, and there's no training manual or guidebook for how to parent, and there's lots of different ideas out there. And when you add on the potential complexity of raising a child or multiple children with now an ex, there's like a whole lot of, you know, emotions and practical challenges that can come up. And it just occurred to us, this is becoming more and more common, as you say, and if there's something that we could do based on our own experience, our own life experience, and then draw on the guidance and expertise of others, that could be a huge contribution to families, you know, really all around the world. And that was a motivation for us.
Even in a so-called traditional nuclear family, parents, I think, learn very quickly that their children can literally play one off the other. Does that compound its situation when the parents are apart?
Yeah, good question. I would say, I mean, we're learning that. I imagine it would be different for different age groups of kids, whether you have adult children. Obviously, that would be different than young ones. And I suspect that there's certainly a certain amount of that, you know, when you're not living day to day with the mother, father of your child, you may not have the same, you know, understanding of agreements in the house or, you know, house rules, things like that, what the child has consumed and the amount of sugar or treats that day, for example. So I think it could be something that comes into play more frequently. But, you know, it's also one of the pieces that becomes, I think, a really great opportunity in what we're creating with the podcast is how can we ensure as parents that we are on the same page, especially as it pertains to kind of core responsibilities and agreements around how we're going to raise our child together apart. Douglas, what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think kids are opportunists, and even Cohen now, she's six, she's often going, well, mom lets me do this or that. And yeah, Leah's right. It's good to have a united front on especially the important things. And yeah, I think we're probably going to be covering some of these topics as we move along in our podcasts, you know, the different areas of things that need honing and then special attention when it comes to children and their relationship to their parents.
Even in the same household, you have parents who might sometimes disagree on a parenting style. Is that also compounded with distance? Are there things you don't agree upon as parents?
Yeah. I mean, I
asked the question.
We're good friends, but we're quite different personalities. And I think that we have established a fairly healthy equilibrium between our parenting styles and our own sort of unique ways of doing things. But we really do come together and especially, you know, putting Cohen first and making that our priority. So that's one of the areas that we seem to really align, and that works for us, and we feel that there's got to be similar equilibriums for other parents and co-parents out there.
Mm-hmm. And I think part of it, Peter, is that we also have, you know, we have the ability to express our unique parenting styles with Cohen independently. And it's something that she also has come to learn and will continue to learn over time, is that, you know, daddy might do it this way, but mommy, you know, does it this way. And so there is a bit of a line that we walk, or a dance, maybe I could say that we do with her, in the fact that there are some things that I think it's really important that we're on, you know, agreement with, especially with respect to, you know, her health and wellness. And then there are matters that we're more flexible on, you know, perhaps how much screen time could be one thing, or, you know, there's all kinds of different areas in parenting that we allow, you know, each other to express our own ways of operating, and that she does a really good job of navigating that. So I think that's a big part of what our listeners will get out of it, of how to navigate that world with their ex and their children.
Is there a good cop, bad cop dynamic in your relationship? And if so, who's the good cop and who's the bad cop?
Oh, that's great. Well, I'll just say that my we had a caregiver who was looking after Cohen in our house when she was quite young, and she would point out that I was much stricter with Cohen than Douglas was, and we had a good laugh about that, because she would go to both of our houses and could see those dynamics. But I'll leave it to Douglas to answer that question further.
No, I think that's probably true. I think that, I wouldn't say LA is the iron fist or anything like that, but she's a bit more vocal than I am, I think, about certain things. And so, yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Okay. So you are co-parenting a child. You are about to embark. You have this new podcast where you're talking about co-parenting. You seem to have a good relationship, so I'll ask the question that I'm sure both of you really hate. And that is, if everything works out so well between the two of you, why are you not together?
I think that when you break up, and it depends on the circumstances, I think sometimes you just, the same way that you can fall in love, I think it's equally possible to fall out of love. And I think that's really what has happened, is we broke up and we found out we were pregnant after the fact, and we just decided to, you know, focus on our relationship as friends and as co-parents without the romantic baggage.
Now, what happens if this hasn't already happened now? What happens if one of you gets into another relationship? How does that work out in the co-parenting dynamic, and how you deal with your child in that situation?
It's a really good question, and I can speak personally that I have had romantic interests who I've introduced to Cohen. I've had, you know, boyfriends. And it has happened, you know, in a discussion, really, and actually very early on. Douglas and I went and sought out professional support in the form of seeing a counselor or a psychologist, who provided some really helpful coaching to us about, especially in those early days, how to navigate that situation. And I think it really ultimately does come down to agreements. Like, what do we feel is appropriate as far as introducing a love interest to our child, and under what circumstances, and how to do that in a way that is respectful of the parent who is introducing this person or finding love in their life, how to do it in a way that is respectful of the parent, who the other co-parent of the child, and of course of this new person who's coming into this new dynamic, this new family dynamic, as you will. So I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all approach here. I think it really is about having open communication and discussing what both parents feel comfortable with and making sure that everybody's on the same page so there aren't, you know, any surprises. As you can imagine, that's kind of a space where things, emotions, I think, could run high. So to do it as respectful as possible is really critical.
I think it's very clear from the idea that you're doing this show and also from part of your last answer when you said that when you started dating, you thought about going to a therapist with Douglas to discuss it. To me, it proves that your daughter is one very lucky girl.
Thanks.
Yeah.
How does one find the show, Adventures in Co-Parenting?
It's going to be on iTunes.
Right.
And you will also be able to listen to it from our website.
Which is adventuresincoparenting.com, correct?
Yeah, and it's adventuresinco-parenting.com.
Excellent, excellent. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Great success with your show coming up. I'm sure it'll be a hit with a lot of parents out there because, as I said earlier, there's a lot of people who are co-parenting their children.
That's great. Thank you so much, Peter. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Take care.
Douglas Bevins and Alea Boisvert, the co-hosts of the podcast Adventures in Co-Parenting. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0495, and you'll find links to their site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's that time you've all been waiting for, boys and girls. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A Florida fugitive wrote a note on a mattress for Flagler County deputies stating that he was aware of the warrant out for his arrest. 40-year-old Jesse Pack of Brunel, out of Volusia County, was wanted on charges of kidnapping and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Deputies arrived at the Brunel home and found a mattress with writing on it placed by the front door. The note said, "I know my warrant is active. I'm not here. I'm finishing a job and turning myself in to Volusia Branch Jail. Signed, Jesse Pack." A woman told deputies Pack was not home, and she granted them permission to search the house. Deputies said they found Pack curled up in the fetal position inside a small wooden dresser with a pillow. Pack had cigarettes and a glass pipe with burnt residue with him. Pack told deputies he hid in the dresser when he heard dogs barking, believing he was going to be arrested. "Ready or not, here we come," Flagler County Sheriff Rick Staley said. "This guy clearly thought he could hide from our deputies, but this is not the first cat-and-mouse game a fugitive has tried to play." Pack was taken into custody. In addition to the Volusia County charges, he has been charged with resisting arrest without violence and possession of drug paraphernalia. Now, why, oh why, would you write a giant note on a mattress for cops saying you're not at home, then hide in a dresser drawer like a baby without a crib, expecting that the cops aren't going to find you? One reason, and one reason only: you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0495. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0495. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Evolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were listening to this at the same time as watching The Wizard of Oz and listening to Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon, well, it's a waste of electricity. There are some things you just can't multitask.